Tuesday for a presentation and book signing of Michael Brownlee's new book, The Local Food Revolution. For more information on our events, you can visit tatteredcovered.com, or you can pick up an events calendar from our checkout counter before leaving tonight. I'm pleased to introduce Medea Benjamin tonight, a champion of humanitarian efforts both at home and abroad. She is the co-founder of the woman-led peace group Code Pink and of the human rights group Global Exchange. She was one of 1,000 outstanding women from 140 countries nominated to receive the Nobel Peace Prize and was a Green Party candidate for the California Senate in 2000. She's the author of 9 books, including her 2013 work, Drone Warfare, Killing by Remote Control. You may have also seen Medea's work appear in the Huffington Post, Common Dreams, and Alternet, to name a few. Without further ado, please help me in giving a warm welcome to Medea.
So thank you very much. It's nice to be here. And I just got back from Standing Rock yesterday, which was an amazing, mind-blowing phenomenon that's going on that sort of epitomizes everything that is wrong with this country and is symbolized by Donald Trump, and everything that a group like the Indigenous community in Standing Rock is trying to counter with a love for nature, for Mother Earth, for passing on a climate for the next generations to come, countering the influence of the big corporate lobbies. And you also see so starkly the influence of the police repression, the state-led repression against people who are defending not only their water and land, but our water and land. And the situation couldn't be more dramatic and drastic and beautiful on the one hand in terms of people putting forth an indigenous-led resistance that's based more than anything I have seen on prayer and ceremony and love and respect and a lot of women in the lead. Amazing way that the women are looking at the police who have been so incredibly repressive, the sheriffs, the tremendous abuse that they have taken, and yet facing it with such compassion for the aggressors. Being on the front lines with them and hearing the women talking to the police saying, "We love you, you are our brothers, we feel for you, we don't think you want to be doing this." It was Thanksgiving time and they kept saying, we're sure you'd rather be home with your families and your loved ones. Put down your weapons, join us. We are all one family. We're all humans, we're all in this together. Quite remarkable, quite incredible. But how long can they go on resisting when the state-led repression is bound to get worse and worse? And it really is so sad to see that in the last days of President Obama's administration, to see him so cowardly, so unwilling to stand up for what is so right and so just and so beautiful is very heartbreaking. And I think history will really record this movement as a time when indigenous communities came together like never before to lead a movement with so many allies around the country, and where the Democratic president, who should have been there with them, calling off the county sheriffs calling off the racist police, protecting them, failed to do his job. On the other hand, I think it is beautiful the way the community writ large, meaning the people around the country and around the world, have seen this as such an important struggle and have come together to provide their bodies, their financial support, their donations, their prayers, their actions in solidarity. And it is so uncertain what's going to happen in the coming days, since there is an eviction notice for December 5th. But to think how in the world you can evict thousands and thousands of people who have dug in for the winter and are absolutely determined to stop this pipeline is something that might turn into an even uglier wave of repression that could lead to could lead to deaths, could lead to some pretty bad battles. And I just want to put that out as a context for this coming administration and the way that we're going to have to be coming together for all different kinds of struggles in the years ahead. And that an example like Standing Rock can give us the courage and the inspiration to come together. And that leads me to the theme I want to talk about with my book tonight, which is another big struggle that we're going to have to wage in the coming years that we should have been waging at a much higher level in the past, and that perhaps now when a lot more people have woken up, we'll be able to do it in a bigger way, in a more effective way. And that is having a foreign policy that has been disastrous. Going back to the time of 9/11, instead of focusing on individuals who attacked us and bringing them to justice, using it as an excuse for invasions of entire countries, including Iraq, that had nothing to do with 9/11, and the consequences have been so disastrous. Those of us who knew it was the wrong thing to do had no idea just how bad it could turn out to be. And to see the creation not only of groups like Al-Qaeda, but of ISIS, you have to trace back to two things. One, the U.S. invasion of Iraq, and the other is Saudi Arabia. And that is because the ideology of these organizations is really based in the ideology of the Saudi state. And that's why I wrote the book, because I thought it was so important when you look at the U.S. saying that it is waging a war on terror, whether or not uses that language or not, spending trillions of our dollars that we need to deal with the tremendous problems we face here at home, killing thousands of our own soldiers in this war, devastating the lives of millions of people in the Middle East, and yet we haven't addressed the root of it, and that is the country of Saudi Arabia. And I realized, as somebody who'd been involved in the peace movement for so many years, that I too was guilty of not looking at Saudi Arabia. And when I started to think about why, you know, I realized that we had put a lot of energy into trying to stop the war in Iraq. We put a lot of energy into trying to support the human rights and just cause of the Palestinian people, trying to stop our government from the continued support of the repressive actions of the Israeli government. But being somebody of Jewish background, my relatives kept saying to me, why aren't you focusing on the repressive Arab countries? Why are you only picking on Israel? And it made me realize that one of the reasons to not focus on Saudi Arabia was the fear of falling into the trap of Islamophobia, feeding into this very dangerous Islamophobia that exists and has been fed with Donald Trump's campaign, and which in the future is going to get even worse. But yet, talking to a number of my Muslim friends, they really encouraged me to do it. And they said, think of Saudi Arabia not as propagating a version of Islam, but as propagating a perversion of Islam. That this is not the kind of Islam practiced by the vast majority of people throughout the world that practice a very compassionate, kind, peaceful version of Islam, and that it's important to distinguish that. And so I did the research on Saudi Arabia and realized that this founding of the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia goes back to the 1700s, when there was an Imam Muhammad Wahhab who had his own interpretation of the Quran that was a very fundamentalist, intolerant version that said, if you don't interpret the Quran the way I do, you are an infidel, and it's okay to kill infidels. It turned out to be a very convenient religious philosophy for the ambitious Saud family that wanted an excuse to go around killing and conquering to take over the Arabian Peninsula, and particularly the holy lands of Mecca and Medina. And so there became this pact between the two of them, which was cemented by the marriage of their children. And by the 1930s, in fact, in 1932, they established the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia. And remember, when you hear the word Saudi Arabia, it is a family that you're talking about. That this is a nation that has been ruled by one family since 1932, with the rule passed down from the founder to the son, to the son, to the son, to the son, so that now they're at a stage where the last son can barely get himself out of bed, and they're trying to figure out who will be the next person in charge. But it has been one family. It's also important to recognize that this regime of one family would most likely have been overthrown by the people that they were trying to rule a long time ago, as other similar rulers had been overthrown, had it not been for one thing, and that's the discovery of oil. Because it is with the discovery of oil in the 1930s, by U.S. companies, in fact, the main one being the U.S. company that's now called Chevron, this Saudi regime became very important to the United States and the West. And in fact, there's a very famous visit that took place during World War II, 1945, between Franklin Delano Roosevelt and King Faisal at that time, where Franklin Delano Roosevelt said, in not such stark terms, we don't really care how you govern your country. We will make sure that you are not overthrown. And this pact of oil for security, as long as you let our Western oil companies reap great profits from your oil and sell cheap oil to us, we will make sure that your kingdom goes on and on and on. And so as we criticize the Saudi regime, let's really do some self-reflection and self-criticism to recognize that it has been the U.S. government that has been propping up this regime for all of these years. This is 12 different U.S. administrations, Democrats, Republicans, liberal, conservative, you name it. They have been supporting a regime that is one of the most repressive regimes in the world. So look at what the Saudis have done internally. They have created a regime where there is no free speech, no free press, no freedom of assembly, no political parties, no labor unions, no voting for any president or national assembly, where there is the death penalty that is used for all kinds of nonviolent reasons, and the death penalty is most often executed by beheadings. In fact, as I was researching the book, I also found that they had something even more gruesome called crucifixion, which was where they would cut off the head of the person and put the body up in a public place with the head off to the side and leave it there for 3 or 4 days as a warning to anyone else. And the reasons that you could be given the death penalty range from all kinds of things. In fact, I would think that here in this room we would have people who might get the death penalty if you lived in Saudi Arabia. For example, anybody in this room an atheist? There you go, lots of you. Anybody in this room identify with the gay community? There you go, second a strike for you. Anybody identify, are there any sorcerers in the room? You're accusing someone else there. Those are some of the reasons. If you insulted the king, if you insult Islam, there was a blogger, Raif Badawi, who had a blog calling for a liberal discussion of issues, who wanted to talk about things like the separation of religion and the state, who wanted to say, why couldn't we have more free thinking in Saudi Arabia? He was originally sentenced to death for that. And one of the reasons was that he was spreading atheism. There was an international outcry, and so his sentence was reduced to 10 years in prison and 1,000 lashes. His lawyer was sentenced to 15 years in prison. This is the way dissent is treated in Saudi Arabia. There are also entire groups of the population that are discriminated against from the time they are born. What do you think of when you think of Saudi women? Covered up. So they have to be totally covered when they're out in public. It's not a choice. Anybody else have something you think of? What did you say? They can't drive. It is the only country in the world where women are not allowed to drive. You ask the Saudis why it is that women are not allowed to drive, and it's very hard to get a straight answer. Some say that because we love our women so much, we have to protect them, and they shouldn't have to drive themselves. A man should drive them. Tell that to a poor single mother who is trying to get a job. Other people would say that they might get attacked if they are out by themselves driving and somebody sees them and gets angry. They could pull them out of the car and attack them. And you, of course, would say, well, why wouldn't you punish the person who attacked them rather than the woman who is driving? The most crazy response was a cleric who issued a fatwa and said women couldn't drive because it would hurt their ovaries. The women that you ask say it is a power trip, and they have been fighting for the right to drive now for many decades, doing civil disobedience, like going out in a car and driving, and then immediately they get stopped, they get put into jail, they can lose their jobs, get sentenced to prison time, to lashes, have their passports taken away, not being able to travel, and yet Every couple of years, a new group of women tries this. But the biggest problem facing women is something called the guardianship system. And that's a system where women, from the time they're born till the time they die, have to have a legal male guardian who gets to decide the most important decisions in a woman's life. What kind of education, what kind of job, who she might marry, when she might get married, if she can travel, all of those kinds of things. And if a woman has an enlightened father or husband, or later in life, perhaps the guardian is her son, she can have a decent life. But if she has an unenlightened guardian, her life can be hell. And many women that I've talked to have had very repressive guardians and say it's like living in jail. So women have been fighting to get rid of the guardianship system. In fact, just last month, there are thousands of women who took a very courageous step of signing a petition asking the king to get rid of the guardianship system. And those kinds of things happen constantly in Saudi Arabia, where women are fighting for more and more rights. But there are other sectors of the population that are repressed as well. I naively thought that a country that was based on religion might have respect for people's freedom to worship as they please. But indeed, that's not the case in Saudi Arabia. I mentioned already that you could get the capital punishment just for being an atheist. But there are other religious groups that have been discriminated against, like the minority Shia, given that Saudi Arabia is a majority Sunni country. The Shia live in the eastern part of the country, which is the oil-rich part of the country. You would think they would be the ones that would get the most benefit from the oil. They'd be the richest part of the population. But indeed, that is not the case. And every time they have risen up just to demand their rights as equal citizens, they have been brutally repressed by the government. There are also many non-Muslims living in Saudi Arabia. You cannot be a Saudi citizen unless you are a Muslim. But there are millions of non-Muslims there because there is a very large foreign worker population. So there are about 2 million Christians that live in Saudi Arabia, and it is illegal for them to build a church or publicly worship. In fact, it's the only country in the world where it is illegal to build a non-Muslim place of worship. Until 2004, it was illegal to even enter Saudi Arabia if you were Jewish. And there are many non-Muslims who have been punished for trying to worship in public or to pass around Bibles. There is a law in the U.S. that I came across as I did the book that was passed in 1998 called the International Freedom of Religion Act. Has anybody heard of that? It's kind of an obscure law that says that because we are such a nation that believes in religious freedom, we will study the rest of the world every year and see how they rank in according to their tolerance of religious freedom. And the ones that are the worst, we'll put in a category called countries of concern, and those countries will be sanctioned. So every year the study is done, and countries like North Korea, country of concern, they get sanctioned. Countries like Burma, or also known as Myanmar, country of concern, they get sanctioned. Saudi Arabia, every year, a country of concern, they never get sanctioned. And I couldn't understand why, because the law says that they should be sanctioned. And it's because in 2004, the State Department passed a waiver saying Saudi Arabia would not be held accountable. And not just a waiver that had to be renewed every year, an indefinite waiver that does not even have to be renewed. So giving the Saudis a free pass to repress people who do not believe in the Wahhabi ideology. I mentioned that there were millions of foreign workers. I mentioned that there were about 2 million Christians, but there's actually about 10 million foreign workers out of a population of 30 million. So almost a third of the population are foreigners. And that came when the Saudis started reaping vast amounts of money from the oil wealth and realized that they could import workers from poor countries who could do the hard labor, building the infrastructure out in the sweltering sun, or doing domestic work, taking care of the children, cooking and cleaning, driving the women. And so they started to import large numbers of workers from countries like India, Bangladesh, the Philippines. And it's not like you could be someone in the Philippines who said, I want to go to Saudi Arabia, see what kind of job I can get, try my luck, try to get a job that pays well and send my remittances back to my family. No, that's not the way it works. The way it works is that you have to have a sponsor in Saudi Arabia that is responsible for you. So you get that job through a sponsorship. You already owe money for your airfare there, for a fee that you've paid to get the job. You get there, and oftentimes the employer might even take your passport away from you. And oftentimes the employees find the foreign workers find that they have been sold a faulty bill of goods. It's not the kind of job they counted on. They are work 12 hours a day, 7 days a week. Domestic workers often find that they are physically abused, maybe even sexually abused. The construction workers find that they're barely even fed decently, not paid what they were told. In fact, sometimes not even paid at all. And you can't even say, this is horrible, I want to go home. Because the only way you can leave is, one, get your passport back, and two, have an exit visa, and the only one who can sign that visa is your employer. So this is like indentured servitude. And in fact, slavery wasn't even abolished in Saudi Arabia until 1962. So you have a system that is repressive against a large sectors of the population inside Saudi Arabia, enforced not only by the police, but also by a special religious police that exists. On top of that, though, you have the fact that the Saudis are exporting their ideology overseas. And that is a relatively recent phenomena that came with the 1979 revolution in Iran, a Shia country, where the Iranian clerics got rid of the Shah, took over the country, declared it an Islamic country that would be a beacon to the Muslims around the world. And the Saudis said, no, our version is the beacon, the guardian of Islam around the world, and we're going to take billions of our petrodollars and start building mosques around the world and build schools around the world, bring in teachers to study inside Saudi Arabia, bring in imams, send them back home, pay their salaries, publish millions and millions and millions of books and send them overseas, give them out free, and spread their ideology. And so in many places you found the creeping extremism of the Saudis coming into play. In fact, President Obama talked about when he lived in Indonesia, which is the largest Muslim country in the world, how their very open, tolerant version of Islam became challenged when the Saudis came in, and you saw where the Saudis had influence, a very different kind of Islam being preached and practiced. Well, it's bad enough that they were spreading this ideology, but they were also then spreading extremism by funding terrorist organizations. They were using money to and charities inside Saudi Arabia to fund terrorist groups. And this we know from cables that have been leaked thanks to WikiLeaks that our government knew full well. In fact, while they were telling us here at home that the Saudi regime was not doing that, this was individual clerics that couldn't be controlled by the Saudi government, the cables say otherwise. The cables say it was indeed the Saudi government that was supporting, at certain periods, groups like ISIS, groups like Al-Qaeda. In fact, a 2014 cable said that was between Hillary Clinton and John Podesta was talking about how we couldn't control the Saudis and their funding of ISIS. There were other cables that Hillary Clinton had written as Secretary of State where she was basically saying, you know, what are we going to do about these Saudis? We can't stop them from funding these groups. Certainly she had a lot of power as Secretary of State, but didn't do anything to really try to control the Saudis' activities. So the Saudis were supporting Al-Qaeda groups in Syria, trying to overthrow Assad. They were also supporting Al-Qaeda groups in Libya, in Iraq, and the U.S. was doing nothing about it. While these relationship between the U.S. and Saudi Arabia should have been questioned here at home as part of this war on terror, unfortunately, neither the White House or the State Department or the Congress was doing anything to change course. And so you really have to look also at us, that we weren't doing anything to force our government to change course. And in fact, you have to wonder how it is that we allowed our government to convince us that they were trying to do something to curb terrorism while they weren't doing anything to change their relationship with the Saudis. Well, I mentioned that the basis of this relationship has been oil, and that is still true today, even though we get a lot less of our oil from the Saudis, only 13% today, a lot less than we did earlier because the U.S. is producing so much of its own oil. But oil is still an important factor. The U.S. Oil companies reap tremendous profits from Saudi oil. They are in joint ventures with the Saudis in terms of oil refineries and all kinds of other oil products. And they want to, the U.S. wants to ensure that the shipping routes in the Persian Gulf are open. But there have been other relationships that have been formed in addition to oil. And the Saudis have been very clever about taking a lot of their petrodollars and investing it in the U.S. economy to give them more leverage. And that ranges from investing hundreds of billions of dollars in U.S. Treasury bonds, investing in many different U.S. corporations, from telecom to real estate. In fact, they have bragged about bankrolling Donald Trump several times when he was in difficult financial straits. They have bought up almost 10,000 acres in California and Arizona. Imagine two states that have had a lot of problems with drought. They have bought up land to grow water-intensive crops like alfalfa that they don't, they're not able to grow back at home, and then ship the alfalfa back for feeding animals in Saudi Arabia. They have invested in high-tech companies. They've invested $3.5 billion in Uber, which is pretty ironic given that half the Saudi population is not allowed to drive. They have also used their money to buy complicity. when I say that we as the public haven't done enough to question this relationship, you should wonder, well, what about all these think tanks in Washington, D.C. that are constantly putting out reports, and some of them are very liberal groups? Why haven't they done more about the toxic relationship with Saudi Arabia? Well, when I did the book, what I discovered is that the Saudis have given millions of dollars to so many of these think tanks, on the right, in the middle, on the left, even groups like the Brookings Institute or the Atlantic Council, very liberal, quote, think tanks. They also have given a lot of money to universities and to Ivy League universities especially. I was at Yale Law School about a month ago, where the Yale Law School had gotten $10 million from the Saudis. And I thought that was pretty ironic, given that there's no rule of law in Saudi Arabia. But went to the law school and met with the person that was in charge of administering the Saudi grant. And we said, well, how can you take money from a country that doesn't respect the rule of law? And they said, well, you know, they gave us the money without any strings attached. And we said, well, how is the money given out? And they said, well, every year we get $1 million. And they look at our program and decide whether they're going to give another million. Of course, that is strings attached. And we said, well, if there are no strings attached, we propose doing a day-long symposium on the lack of rule of law in Saudi Arabia. And they said, well, you know, that's interesting. We'll think about it. And of course, we are waiting for an answer. Another thing that the Saudis do is give to foundations. You might have heard of one famous foundation that has taken quite a lot of Saudi money. The Clinton Foundation, that's right. The Clinton Foundation took between $10 and $25 million from the Saudi government. Even Jimmy Carter's foundation, that has a very strong program to empower girls and young women, took money from the Saudis. Some of you might know that my group, Code Pink, often goes into the hearings in Congress, and we get up with our signs and yell out our truths and often get arrested. Well, one day there was a hearing about the threat of terrorism that was being chaired by the chair of the Armed Services Committee in the Senate, John McCain. And I was sitting in the audience, determined not to speak out that day because I had things to do in the afternoon and I couldn't get arrested. And so I was sitting there just biting my tongue. But John McCain kept harping on the real problem being Iran, and that the Iranians are spreading terrorism around the world, the Iranians are repressing their own people, that Iran is a threat to our allies overseas and a threat to us at home. And I just couldn't keep quiet anymore and jumped up and said, Senator McCain, why don't you ever speak out about the role of Saudi Arabia in spreading terrorism? And he gaveled the hearing to a close and called the police to get me out. And while I was waiting for the police, I quickly Googled John McCain, Saudi Arabia, and up popped a Bloomberg News report that showed that John McCain had recently taken $1 million for his foundation from Saudi Arabia. So just imagine, I mean, at that moment, I thought I was in the Twilight Zone, you know, that here are the people that are supposedly trying to fight terrorism and representing us, and yet they are in bed with the Saudis, literally taking money from the Saudi regime. And so when you look at this entanglement, there's one other piece of it that became so obvious to me as perhaps up there with oil as the reason that we have this relationship, and that is the issue of weapons sales. The Saudis have become the number one purchaser of U.S. weapons. We have had the largest weapon sales to Saudi Arabia of any weapon sales we've ever had in our history. And the majority has happened under the Obama administration in these last 8 years. The sales are staggering. The amounts are staggering. It is $115 billion worth of weapon sales in the last year alone. 42 different deals in the last 8 years alone. The Saudi regime is propping up the military-industrial complex in the United States. The Saudis are not just buying from the U.S. They're the number one purchaser of weapons from Canada, from the UK, from Germany, from France, from Sweden. They're buying weapons from all the Western countries that put themselves forward as these great defenders of democracy, and they are selling massive amounts of weapons to the Saudis. What are the Saudis doing with these weapons? Using them for internal repression, repressing neighboring countries, like during the Arab Spring, when the neighboring Bahrain had a beautiful, peaceful, citizen-led uprising against a dictatorship and did an occupation of the main square in the capital, and were on the verge of success when the Saudis rolled in with U.S. tanks to crush that uprising. The Saudis, as I mentioned before, have also used those weapons to support Al-Qaeda affiliates in Syria, Iraq, Libya. And then starting now 20 months ago, the Saudis began a tremendously destructive war against the poorest country in the region, and that is Yemen. There was an internal strife where one group called the Houthis, who practice a religion that is similar to Shiism, and the Saudis were worried that they would have an alliance with Iran. And so the Saudis came in thinking, a la George Bush, we'll just drop a bunch of bombs and put our person in place and it'll all be over very quickly. In the meantime, it's been going on for almost 2 years. And the situation in Yemen is catastrophic. It's a war we barely hear about in our media, and there's no excuse for it because there's plenty of footage that's available. If you look at overseas news sources, you can get lots of information. Even the UN and Human Rights Watch and Amnesty International, the Red Cross have put out lots of information showing not only have there been thousands and thousands of innocent people killed, but the destruction of the infrastructure has been so devastating that there is now severe malnutrition for millions of young children, that there is a cholera outbreak because the water system has been bombed, because the hospitals and the clinics have been bombed. There was a study that showed a third of the targets have been civilian targets, like marketplaces, residential neighborhoods, schools, clinics, weddings, funerals. And the U.S. has not only provided the weapons for this war, but they have also provided all of the maintenance for the equipment. They refuel the planes in the air. They give logistical support, targeting support, and have given diplomatic cover as well. So the Yemeni people, many of them, see this as a war by the United States, which is going to have repercussions against us for many, many, many years to come. And it's only now, because of the war in Yemen, that some of our representatives in Congress are starting to stand up and say maybe we shouldn't be selling them weapons while they are involved in what looks very much like war crimes in Yemen. And so we, as the grassroots community, managed to force a vote in the Senate. You would think that we'd be able to get 100 senators to vote against these weapon sales. But no, we only got 27 of them to vote against weapon sales. And that's why I think it's so important that we launch a campaign to demand an end to weapon sales to the Saudi regime. And this is something that that is part of my book tour and why I asked you to sign up on the Code Pink sheet that's going around, or for the listeners to go to codepink.org and sign up, because it's a very, very important campaign that we have to wage. The other piece of this is not only to demand that our government stop selling weapons, but also focus on the weapons industry here at home. And for this, I think we have to look at the environmental community that has done such a good job to focus on the fossil fuel industry and demand divestment, that the institutional investors, whether they are universities or religious groups or pension funds, take their money out of the fossil fuel industry, and actually trillions of dollars have been removed. We have to do a similar kind of thing with the weapons industry. You might recall when the Pope was here last year, and he spoke before Congress, and one of the things that he said was that he asked why it is that we sell weapons to people who will use this to inflict such pain and suffering on other people. And the answer, he said, is money. It's money that's drenched in blood. And he said, we are complicit if we don't challenge this. We are complicit if we're silent. We're complicit if we don't stand up to the arms industry. And it was quite ironic, because a bunch of Congress people then jumped up and started clapping. And I thought, you know, how funny, because these are the very people that take money from the weapons industry, because the weapons industry is so clever that they produce pieces of their weapons in every single congressional district of this country. And then they have their lobby groups that give money to the Congress people, and these Congress people then turn around and say, we couldn't possibly stop sales of weapons to the Saudis, or we couldn't possibly stop the production of this particular weapon, even if the Pentagon says they don't want it, because this is jobs in my community. So we have to stand up to this. We have to stand up to the weapons industry. We have to stand up to the corruption of the political system that fuels this kind of activity. And lastly, in terms of Saudi Arabia, we have to look at who are the real Democrats. Who are the Saudis who are trying to change their government? And many of the Saudis that I have met say to me, look, this government cannot last forever. There is a crisis right now, given that the price of oil has gone down to about $43 a barrel, when it was at one point up to $110 a barrel. The Saudis are running on a deficit that's about $100 billion a year right now. They have had to retract a lot of the welfare state kind of benefits that they once gave out to their people. And so the Saudis that I've been in touch with have said, look, there might be an overthrow of this kingdom, and you know who would do it? It would be groups like Al-Qaeda. It would be groups like ISIS, and things would be way worse than they are now. There would be horrendous chaos in Saudi Arabia. And that's why it's so important that we have reform right now. That's why it's so important that we support those women who are trying to lift the guardianship system, or those people who are trying to blog and have a national dialogue over the internet about what kind of system of government we want. That's why it's so important to support the human rights lawyers or the academics who are meeting with the more liberal people within the Saudi kingdom, who and saying to them, look, we are an absolute monarchy. We need to move to a constitutional monarchy like many countries around the world have. You can continue to have a king and a queen and be symbolic figures, but we need a government that's ruled by a constitution, by the rule of law. These are the kinds of things that we should be supporting. We should be supporting the people who are in prison right now for peaceful dissent. One example that my group Code Pink did is that we were contacted by the parents of a young man, 17 years old, who was imprisoned for a peaceful protest. And they gave us some footage of him at home with his family, a lovely young man. We put together a very short 2-minute piece and said, contact the Saudi embassy, ask for his release, contact the State Department. We thought maybe a couple of thousand people would watch it. A couple of weeks later, over 4 million people had watched the video. And when we looked at the back end, we realized that most of them were from Saudi Arabia. And we were getting flooded with thank yous from people inside Saudi Arabia telling us, we have to get this out. People have to understand how repressive this government is. And his parents told us they think the only reason he's still alive is because of the international attention that he has been receiving. So these are the kind of people that we have to be supporting. And so lastly, I want to bring it back out into the larger issue of where we go under a Trump administration. We don't know where Trump is going in terms of foreign policy. He says one thing one day and something else the other day. One of the very dangerous things I think he's saying is around wanting to rip up the Iran nuclear deal, the foreign policy achievement of the Obama administration, something the Saudis and the Israelis would very much like to see. That would be really horrendous and could lead us into another major war in the Middle East. On the other hand, it does seem like Donald Trump wants to focus on domestic issues and not keep us entangled in wars overseas. We just don't know. But it does mean that we have to be a much more mobilized, aware citizenry, because he is surrounding himself by neocons, he's surrounding himself by the very people who got us into the war in Iraq, the very people who are saying, tear up this deal with Iran. The very people, including Donald Trump, who during his campaign signed new business deals in Saudi Arabia. So what kind of movement can we build under Donald Trump? I think building up a movement that's calling for an end to our overseas wars is important to do. But it has to be a movement that is really part of a much larger peace and social justice and environmental movement. We can't continue to work in silos, not supporting other people's movements, because that is not an effective way to organize. I think it's now time that people realize that we have to be all environmentalists. We have to be all peace people. We have to be all people who are protecting those who are being attacked because they are Muslims. We have to be people who are protecting the immigrants who are living here and contributing so much to our society. We have to be part of the movements for a $15 an hour wage. We have to be part of the movements that come out of the Bernie Sanders campaign, when so many people realized that what our problem was not one individual issue or another individual. It was the whole damn system that's the problem. It's the capitalist system that's the problem. And to see that during Bernie Sanders' campaign that he became a hero, not only to older folks, but to so many young people who saw him as like the coolest thing around, that they were getting tattoos with his face on them. There were polls that were done during his campaign that said that for young people, they had a more favorable view of socialism than of capitalism, is really quite remarkable. And it means that there's a lot of people out there now who are ready for something dramatically different. Unfortunately, some of them voted for Donald Trump. But many of them will soon see that that was a big mistake. See already the biggest movements that we've had since the days of George Bush. We see young people mobilizing like never before. I have friends who are teachers who said they've never seen anything like it, with people in the high schools who walked out after Donald Trump were elected, who are demanding teach-ins about what it's going to look like under Donald Trump and what they can do to fight for justice. Certainly in every college that I have have traveled to in the last couple of weeks, there have been major mobilizations. So there is a lot of organizing. I live in Washington, D.C., and already just in these last 2 weeks, people are organizing for so many things just around the inauguration. The day before, in the balls that they have to as part of the inauguration party, we in the peace movement have rented out the entire African-American Museum for a peace ball with thousands of people who will come to that. There are plans for all kinds of mobilizations on the day of the inauguration, the day after, a women's march that people are renting buses and coming in from all over the country for that. And that is just the days of the inauguration. There are going to be a lot of mobilizing and organizing in the days ahead. While I think the Donald Trump election was a tremendous, and is a crisis for this country, it is also an opportunity for us. And there is an opportunity to build a progressive movement like we haven't seen in many, many years. Look back at the McCarthy era and see what came out of that disaster was the civil rights movement, the women's movement, the gay rights movement. So let's recognize the opportunity that we have in front of us, the way that we could be in solidarity with so many different people on so many different important critical social justice issues. Let's build a movement that is so strong that no wall that Trump puts up can keep us away from each other. No police barricades that they put up can keep us away from each other. No protest pens that they try to keep us in can keep us away from each other. Let's build a really strong, effective peace, justice, environmental movement that can demand from whoever is in the White House and in the Congress the kind of country that we want to live in internally and the kind of foreign policy that we want to be proud of overseas that makes people not hate us, but makes people love us around the world. Let's do it. Thank you. So we have time for some discussion. Yes. Wait, I just called on the woman. The Carlyle Group? Oh, they have tremendous dealings with the Saudis. They have dealings around the oil industry. They work with the Saudis inside Saudi Arabia as well as in Texas, where they have joint operations. Yeah. Is there somebody here that could talk about the weapons manufacturers in Colorado? Raytheon, definitely here. Lockheed Martin. General Dynamics, I know, is here. So I've been talking to some of the people at the universities about trying to do a divestment campaign at their universities. And there's a lot of interest in that. But we are collecting these names and rolling out a campaign on that, and we're hoping that people will join us. About what?
Any rumors about them
financing 9/11? Did I hear rumors about Saudis financing 9/11? Well, you know, 15 of the 19 hijackers were from Saudi Arabia. You know that about 140 Saudis got whisked out of this country just days after 9/11, before commercial planes were even flying. And we know that there's a lot of information that hasn't been released by our government about how high up the in the chain the relationship between the hijackers was and the Saudi government. That's why the 9/11 families have been fighting so much to get the right to sue Saudi Arabia in U.S. courts, something that they just won despite a veto of President Obama overridden by Congress. And we will see now in the months and years to come if the what former Senator Bob Graham, who was in charge of the 9/11 Commission, says are 80,000 pages of FBI investigations that we have not been able to see, if through the court processes we might be able to get that information released to the public. Saudi Arabia and Israel have been enemies for a long time, with the Saudis not having diplomatic relations with Israel, the Saudis having a blockade against Israel, until recently, when both the Saudis and the Israelis recognized that they both had a common enemy, and that was Iran. And so they started working together to try to nix the Iran nuclear deal. And once the deal was signed, they've been working together, originally clandestinely and now openly, to try to figure out how to, in the next administration, get that deal overturned, and how to make sure that the U.S. does not move to having any closer relationships with Iran.
Did you get arrested
that day? No, I just got thrown out.
Have you been arrested?
Oh, many, many, many times. Yeah. I tried to get into Saudi Arabia many times, and I've been all in the countries all next to Saudi Arabia, you know, and Yemen and Bahrain, but the Saudis would never let me in. And so I worked with people inside Saudi Arabia and people who live in the diaspora. In fact, some friends that worked with me in Washington, D.C. And so we would send chapters encrypted to people inside Saudi Arabia. They would write back their response. And we had a lot of back and forth. I feel really bad that I could not acknowledge them in the book, because it would be too dangerous for them. But a lot of help from many Saudis. Well, let's remember that al-Qaeda came from the U.S. and Saudi Arabia creating the Mujahideen in Afghanistan to overthrow the Soviets, and then that turned into al-Qaeda. But in terms of now the Saudis continuing to support al-Qaeda affiliates, yes. So the question is the current state of ISIS and these other groups, and the answer is very complex, because it's like the Frankenstein that the U.S. and al-Qaeda created. They create ISIS, they create al-Qaeda, and then they can't control them. And so then ISIS and al-Qaeda turn around and start attacking the U.S. and Saudi Arabia. So you see there are attacks inside Saudi Arabia by both al-Qaeda and ISIS. They accuse the Saudi government of not being true to the ideology, of being in cahoots with the West. For example, Osama bin Laden said that the turning point in his life was when the Saudi government made an agreement with the U.S. to allow 500,000 U.S. troops to go through the Saudi Holy Lands in the first Gulf War. So the al-Qaeda-type groups see the Saudi government as a co-opted government, and now are trying to overthrow them. Well, they've received funding earlier on when they were getting started, and then go out of control. And then there are all sorts of branches then of these groups that go off on their own. And you know, who knows, some of the bombings inside Saudi Arabia, some people say they're done by the Saudi government themselves to say, see, you know, we are fighting ISIS. Who knows what the truth is? We do know that in the beginning of the creation of these groups, the Saudis were there. Well, that's right. I mean, Wahhabism is the ideology that is still in place in Saudi Arabia. And there is an issue of government support. So in 2014, the government was supporting ISIS. They probably are not doing the same today. But then there are individual rich Saudis who are. And that is something that the government says they can't control. So it's phases, and it's groups that are created that then have a life of their own. And it is very hard to distinguish sometimes when it's the government, when it's individuals within the Saudi nation, and not the government. I think we have time for maybe one more question, comment. Well, that's why I suggested that you be in touch with us. There are, in the next Congress, there's going to be another round of weapon sales. And since we got 27 senators, we want to get a majority of senators. We want to demand a vote in the House side as well. So that's something very important to us. We have other campaigns. We have a campaign now about Uber, for example, that we are demanding, and we're going to be putting out flyers you can download if you take Uber, and you can either call Uber or you can ask the Uber drivers to also help us in this campaign to demand that the CEO of Uber put out a public letter to the King of Saudi Arabia saying, we think the women of Saudi Arabia should have the right to drive, and we would like women to be Uber drivers in Saudi Arabia. So we've got a number of different campaigns, and we'd love your help on them. So thank you all very much, and I hope you buy copies of the book. I'm happy to sign them up here. It's a very easily readable book. It's in Q&A form. It's meant to be a basic primer, a 101 on Saudi Arabia, and it's the kind of book that you can not only read easily, but pass around to friends, maybe donate to the library when you're done. We really need to educate people around this issue. So thank you so much, and thanks to the wonderful bookstore. Terrific. And they buy books at the front, and then I sign them here. Is that how it works? Yeah.
Well, sign first.
Yeah.